This is LI in the AM with Jay Oliver. News, traffic, weather, and more. 1039 LI News Radio.
And we're back at 808. Very, very big election year, as I've stated many a time. In the fact that, although not a federal election, I think a very important election, because especially in Suffolk County, where you have a district attorney spot that is now open after 16 years, Tom Spoda walks into the sunset. You also have a sheriff's position, highly coveted. You also have legislative positions, both counties, 18, 19 spots at stake, supervisor posts and everything else. Here to talk about it from Millennial Strategies, Jeff Guillot, also political science professor extraordinaire over at community colleges, right? Suffolk and Nassau, County Community. And we welcome Jeff to the airwaves. First time, met him a couple of weeks ago, impressed. Told him, you know what, we got to get you in here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here, man.
Absolutely.
Political science professor.
That's right.
So you are a political junkie as well, eh? Are you?
I guess you could say that. And I think teaching poli-sci over at Suffolk is probably the best 6 hours of my week every week. I really get a lot out of it.
Yeah.
But in my day job, I run Millennial Strategies, which is a political consulting firm with offices in Huntington Village and in Lower Manhattan.
Very nice. Did you agree with my assessment somewhat as far as a very important year? Obviously, every election year is important, although no congressional spots at stake here. Listen, you got important posts. You're looking Suffolk County, right?
Well, here's the thing. And while federal overtones dictate a lot of your election results, one thing that a lot of people don't understand is that these town and county races have more of an impact on how your tax dollars are spent and therefore how government interacts with your lives than your higher level statewide or federal races. And they always do. And because of you have depressed voter turnout in a lot of these races, your vote goes a lot further in your town and county
races. Is there a remedy for that, though? Because there is such apathy when it comes to getting to the polls. Is there a way to maybe strengthen it as far as getting people out there?
Oh, sure. I mean, there are a litany of state-level remedies you could put in place that can increase voter turnout. There just doesn't seem to be a tangible interest in doing that in Albany and in a lot of state houses around the country. I mean, New York has some of the most draconian voter registration processes in the country.
Yeah.
We don't allow for...
Because there's deadlines and everything else. You got to get in at a certain point, otherwise you're stuck.
If someone could find me a way to go online and register to vote in the state of New York, I will buy you dinner because you can't do it.
Right.
And furthermore, we don't allow for early voting like a lot of states do, which always increases voter turnout. We don't allow for same-day registration, which always increases
voter
turnout. Other
states have that.
Absolutely. We don't allow for mail-in voting. I mean, the state of Oregon is entirely mail-in voting, which allows people to have more time to review a race and more time to think about it. I mean, I personally think that we should go to more of a presumed consent model, which is more what Oregon has, where everyone on your 18th birthday is automatically registered to vote and you have to opt out of the system. Right now, we have an opt-in system, and the only time ever in your life, in your entire existence on this planet, that you're prompted to register to vote is when you get your driver's license at the DMV. And, I mean, it's been a while since I've been to the DMV in Hop Hog, but I don't remember a great feeling of civic responsibility washing over me when I was there trying to get my driver's license. So there's so many things we could do to get people to participate in government. Millennials are about to be the largest part of America's voting population, and their voting numbers are really, really depressing.
What about putting the process on a weekend? Why on a Tuesday?
I'm all for that. I mean, take a look.
You'd have more interest, more flexibility. People who come home from work are shot. You know what? Got to get to the polls. Got to eat dinner first. Put the kids to bed. Spend some time with the wife. You know, then you get to the polls. You know, and some people do, and some people don't. Why not have it on a Saturday? Sunday?
The reason why America holds elections on Tuesdays is because when America was a largely agrarian economy in the 18th century, Tuesday was the day that farmers brought their crops to market. That's why we do this on Tuesday. Former Congressman Steve Israel has long been a champion of holding elections on weekends, and look no further than the recent French election to see that these things work. In France, in their very, very important presidential elections, they had 78% turnout. on an election held on a Sunday. That's 78% of the voting eligible population participated in democracy. We don't come close to those numbers. In the 2016 presidential election, you were looking at something like 53%.
Yeah.
That means 47% of the voting eligible population stayed home on election day.
All right, let's check in with a couple of races. I'm going to start in Nassau. Are you a Nassau guy originally, or
no? I'm a Suffolk guy.
You're a Suffolk guy.
Yeah, went to Hop Hog High,
okay.
And I live with my wife and son in Babylon Village.
By the way, we should point out Mr. Guillot here is a new dad, Lincoln James.
Lincoln James, 12 days old. He's listening right now. Just remember to vote in November, Lincoln.
There you go.
Vote early, vote often.
So, you know, I look at the county executive race in Nassau, a bittersweet. You know, I think a lot of people would like Ed Mangano to get his just desserts. Yet, you go to the field and you've got a guy named Jack Martin, state senator, Laura
right.
Curran involved here. And then you have an individual who is the controller, who did a kind of a party switch here. Maragos and Curran will do a little bit of a primary battle for the right to face off against state senator Jack Martin. But that's kind of an interesting caveat there.
I think this thing is wide open at this point. I mean, it's hard to handicap a clear favorite in the county executive race right now. I think that if you're to handicap the primary, you have a really, really fascinating dichotomy between two candidates.
Yeah.
Maragos is going to have to dodge the fact that he was at one point in his life, fairly recently, a Tea Party Republican.
And by the way, people always look at finances.
Oh, sure.
And if the affiliation aligns Maragos with what's happening, I mean, listen, he is the county controller. Guess what? You know, it could be curtains for Maragos. But, you know, he has that. The thing with elections I always find is name recognition always prevails.
Oh, sure. Sure. And it certainly helped Ed Mangano in 2013. Maragos has long enjoyed a pretty solid name recognition. Laura Curran is a county legislator, so she's got name rec in her one district.
Yeah.
But a lot of folks probably identify the name Maragos and don't really know what political party he's from. So you certainly could see the effects of the party shift being, not as profound in that sense. But you're going to have a situation where Maragos is going to rely on talking about being experienced, being the candidate with integrity because he's self-financing his campaign, and therefore he's claiming he's not beholden to other political interests, to the county contractors whose meddling in the political process has been the downfall of many people throughout Nassau County politics. And then you have Laura Curran, who's going to kind of run the Democratic purity test on Maragos. And she's also supported by, the Nassau County political establishment, as well as a lot of organized labor, which in a Democratic primary can have a big impact on the polls. A
ton of unions, certainly.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing that in, back to the issue of voter turnout, right?
Yeah.
Nassau County has 1.3 million residents. In the 2013 Democratic primary between Adam Haber and Tom Suozzi, you saw 33,000 people vote in that primary. 33,000 Democratic voters had a huge say in who the next county executive was going to be. I think turnout in this race, because neither of those people has the same kind of name recognition that Tom Suozzi had 4 years ago, is going to be lower. So for Curran and Maragos, you're looking at a number of less than 15,000 Democrats, again, of a county of 1.3 million, 15,000 people, could have the biggest impact as to who your next county executive is. Because regardless of who wins the primary and regardless of what you see in the general election, so much of this narrative is going to be driven by people's opinions on the president.
Yeah.
That, you're going to see Trump as a huge, huge factor, and Nassau County did not go for the president in the last election.
Well, let's face it. I mean, with Mangano out, and by the way, he was contemplating what I don't know. I mean, are you serious? You've got charges and everything else being levied at you. But that's a big topic. I mean, corruption and everything else. But Nassau County with a massive deficit.
We know
they are in financial trouble beyond here. And that could be associated with the George Maragos. You never know. Like we said, affiliation and whatnot. But, nonetheless, that's a tough act to follow with Ed Mangano. I mean, one has to be on top of their game here.
I am a firm believer.
I mean, to portray to the residents, listen, we're going to turn it around and everything else. You got property taxes up the wazoo and everything.
Well, one, I'm a firm believer that the job of Nassau County Executive is probably the worst job in New York State politics, because you're right. I mean, you have a situation where a control board appointed by the state of New York has essentially taken Nassau County's wallet
away. Plus, you have knife involved. Well, that's the National Finance Authority.
You have one of the most affluent counties in the United States, but yet they operate.
But they need help.
Deficit. It's unbelievable.
They need the crutch. They need the crutch of NYFA. You have a controller there. You know, George Marigos. You know, what's going on here? Well, we still can't get it together.
Well, right. And also, Nassau County's assessment system is probably the most flawed assessment system in the state of New York. They have a state statute that creates what's called a county guarantee that makes them operate in a way that is different than Suffolk, different than Westchester, different than every other comparable suburb. And not to get too wonky on this, but it leads to a situation where the county is applying so much debt service that they can't get out of their own way. That needs to be fixed, and that's something that has to be done in Albany, not on the county level. And Mangano, when running for re-election, accurately stated that we need relief from our state representatives in order to fix this. And so the assessment system is going to be an albatross on everyone's back in this election, and because everyone has a way to fix it. But ultimately, you know, we need help from Albany in order to do that.
No question about it. Jeff Guillot here, Millennial Strategies. He is a political science professor, both the Suffolk community and Nassau as well. Talking some politics, important elections coming into play. And you look at the legislatures on both sides, Nassau and Suffolk. Nassau especially. Listen, you know, when I think of the Nassau legislature, I'm thinking about these contracts for some reason that have been mishandled to the point, and you wonder, how do they ever get through? And that's something that is going to be on the minds of many a resident out in Nassau County. Get a lot of positions changing. You got a presiding officer, Norman Gonzalez, pretty much gone, right? You know, you have a lot of new blood coming into play here. So if you are on that Nassau legislature and you have a seat there, beware. People are watching.
Sure. And I think, I mean, specific to contracting, I think that kind of trickles down into the issue of corruption at large.
Think of the Dean Skelos deal.
Oh, sure.
I mean, right, AppTech and everything else.
There's polling out there indicating that corruption as a campaign issue resonates more with voters than even finances does. And you saw that manifested in your state Senate races with Mike Vindel.
And you saw
year.
It manifested in Albany because they really could not get that comprehensive ethics reform package cemented. They gave you a couple of little bits and pieces, but nothing firm.
It's very hard to ask any legislative body to police itself and to end the systems that have allowed them to be able to enrich themselves over time. It's just human nature to not want to do that. And that's one of the reasons why progress at every level of government as it pertains to ethics is really, really incremental.
Yeah, no question about it. So certainly a lot in the line. Let's go to Suffolk County because big races here. You know,
oh, yeah.
I'm looking at this DA's race. You know, you got a police commissioner here in Suffolk County who's vying for that post. Listen, I don't think 20 seconds elapsed when Tom Spoda said, you know what, I'm not running anymore. And then you heard the name Tim Sini coming in. But a lot of controversy here because a lot of people say, well, how do you hold two here? You're vying for the post, and yet you're holding on to the commissioner's job. We got a lot of stuff going on out here. You got the gangs and the drugs. How do you do it? He's been under the scope.
I think that Tim Sini is a rock star in this business, and I think that the DA's race is very much his to lose. And
he's got the backing. Let's
face it. Oh, yeah. Look.
I mean, he's got cross endorsements from every party, including my nephew's birthday party in 2 weeks. You know, I mean, in essence,
the my nephew's birthday party line is good for about 1% of the overall
pretty
vote.
Pretty much,
see,
right?
That's a big deal.
But he's got every party
I read that
endorsement.
Press
yeah. I mean, listen, Ray Perini, he's got a lot to do here.
Oh, yeah. I think, like I said before, I think Tim Sini is one of the great rising stars in Long Island politics. And I think the way that they were able to negotiate this potential conflict of interest as it pertains to his position as PC and his role as a candidate, I think, was a masterstroke. Immediately upon Sini announcing that he was a candidate for the district attorney's seat, they also released a legal opinion that they were able to obtain, stating unequivocally that, one, it was okay that he, as a sitting PC, run for DA. And two, Commissioner Sini has made it very, very clear that he is not actively front.
Well, we know that David Kelly pretty much is doing everything for him.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is,
always good to have the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District in your
public
corner.
Opinion, though, says, you know what, I don't like it. I mean, that's pretty much it. I mean, you're holding down the post and you're vying for this. You know, can you really do both?
Well, I guess we'll find out in November.
I think
the voters will state emphatically that, yes, this is a good thing. Tim Seedy should be the top cop in Suffolk County.
And bottom line, listen, you got PBA backing. You're in. I mean, it's real. History proves, right? I mean, you know, it's the kiss of death for an opponent who does not. PBA backing in either county, I mean, you're a shoo-in. Let's face it.
I don't think it makes you a shoo-in, but I do think that people certainly respect the opinion of law enforcement out here.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens. A lot on the line there. Of course, the sheriff's position as well, with Vince DiMarco leaving after three terms or so. And, you know, you've got a state senator now who has moved into that slot, Phil Boyle. And a lot has been made there, because does Phil Boyle have that experience as an enforcement guy? And the answer is no. Now, we had Phil on the air. He's a great guy, and he has a lot of contacts. And he says, you know what? I'm going to get my experience and everything else, all through people I deal. You know, if you look at this position, the sheriff's position has been around in this county for 300-plus years. And very few people have the enforcement experience. You know, people who are a cop, whatever. You know, it's about Phil Boyle says, you know what? I've got the relationships to get through here.
Well, I mean, just to take it back for a second, I have really no earthly idea why Suffolk County or any county anywhere elects a sheriff. It doesn't make a whole world of sense to me. It would seem that you would want to appoint the most qualified person to be the county's sheriff. For one, we appoint our police commissioners. We don't elect sheriffs in Nassau County. We don't elect sheriffs in New York City. We don't elect sheriffs in Westchester. I'm not quite sure why this exists. It is probably an antiquated harbinger to another time. Secondly, I mean, in defense of Senator Boyle, he did chair the Senate Committee on Codes. Now, as a former staffer in Albany, in the state capitol, I can attest to the fact that it is the Codes Committee that deals with all law enforcement issues. So certainly from a policy perspective, this is a man who knows law enforcement issues and knows law enforcement policy, both in the county and on the state level. And you could make an argument that that makes him qualified for this seat. But I think the bigger intrigue around the sheriff's race is not necessarily will Phil Boyle win.
He's got that name.
Once he wins this primary, and I think he will, but he does have a spirited primary challenger who deserves respect.
Larry Zegarese.
Absolutely.
Oh, by the way, he will run on the Reform Party line. Even if he loses the primary, he'll run. You know, his name will still be out there.
Sure, sure. But I do think the bigger intrigue here around Boyle and around the sheriff's office is not will Boyle become the next Suffolk County sheriff. I think the odds are, you know, 95% that he does. However, what happens when he vacates that seat in the state Senate, right, and when he vacates that seat, that is the intriguing thing about the sheriff's
race.
Good
point there.
I mean, there have been a lot of news reports about the fact that Boyle, if he wins the primary, may resign that seat before September 20th. If he does so, you're going to see a state Senate special election that could take place on Election Day in November. If you want to see an absolute bonanza of special interest spending, of labor unions, of charter schools, of every business group known to man on this planet, yeah, dumping money into a district that is entirely located in Suffolk County, that's what you'll see if this takes place, because control of the chamber itself could very much be up for grabs in this race. And it's a special election, which means the county chairs appoint the candidate.
Jeff Guillot, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll have Jeff stick around a little bit more. I want to talk a little national stuff.
Awesome.
Still some stuff in Suffolk County. Jeff, of course, Millennial Strategies and a political science professor extraordinaire, Suffolk County Community College now. Jeff Guillot, my guest, he from Millennial Strategies out in the Huntington area. He's been there 5 years, his company. And it's really a marketing strategic type of firm.
Yes, that's correct.
You do a lot of different things with many a client.
Yeah, we do. Years. We do political campaigns, issue advocacy, and you know, and some direct lobbying as well.
There you go. He's also a professor of political science in both NASA and Suffolk, right? Community colleges. And you've been doing
it's
that
labor a of love.
Yeah, there you go. Doing that a lot. Suffolk does a nice job there. Now, we're speaking a lot about these races coming up. You know, it's funny, you know, with primary day, really September the 12th, you know, you think about primary day way back in the past as a meaningful day. But the fact of the matter is, you know, a lot of candidates who are on there, if they lose, they just go to another party. I mean, they're still on the ballot come November. So in essence, when you think about it, in some of these primaries, what does it all mean? Doesn't mean the cancellation completely of one. It just means that they are moving on to another umbrella, so to speak.
Sure. I think the primary day is a lot more important in places that are not Nassau and Suffolk County, too.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at New York City, because of the Democratic Party's control of the New York City Council, for example, you know, that's a legislative body with 52 seats, 48 of which are held by Democrats.
Yeah.
Primary day is election day in New York City because you have a monolithic system. So in urban areas or in your rural areas where the Republican Party maintains a stranglehold of control, primaries become all the more important. Here in Nassau and Suffolk, on both sides of the aisle, there is a concerted effort to limit primaries. Primaries cost money. They're not good for incumbents. And as a result, there is a concerted effort to try to limit those. Given the barrier to entry that the petitioning process presents, that also means that it's easy to be able to try to knock off inexperienced candidates who don't get enough petition signatures.
Yeah, no question.
Which is an annual boon for election lawyers on both sides of the political spectrum.
So, you know, we spoke a lot about the Nassau races and most of the Suffolk races. In essence, you got the same situation regarding the Suffolk legislature. And again, all eyes upon, because, you know, you look at deficits and, you know, even though this county executive is not up for re-election this year, there's still a lot of questions here, you know, as finances. Same deal. You have deficits. You have a legislature that has made some moves here with votes and whatnot. You have all these parking violations and fees on top of fees on top of fees. You have the red light cameras. You know, you wonder where both counties are going regarding finances and how do they kind of streamline revenue in the proper way. I think a lot of people are, we've had on many a legislator, and they call it a tax. Let's face it. The red light camera stuff, it's a tax. The fees on top of the parking violations, it's a tax. Any way you look at it, it's a tax. They're taxing people out of these counties. People can't afford to live here. People don't want to live here. Let's face it. If your kids are out of the school system, why are you hanging around here?
No,
that
sure
is the mindset, Jeff. That's the mindset right now going on here.
Well, I would take your position on red light cameras one step further. I mean, there are those who categorize red light cameras as a regressive tax on the poor. And there are also those who consider them to be unconstitutional. I mean, you have a right in this country to confront your accuser in a court of law. If you get nailed for a red light camera, who are you confronting in court? An automated system? There's a lot of problems with this. But at the end of the day, these are the kinds of things you have to do when you face a structural deficit. Your listeners should be educated to the fact that increases in fees are absolutely taxes. And you see those in both counties. And you're right. While the county executive in Suffolk is...
It's a money grab. A lot of people say it's a money grab.
While he's not on the ballot, his policies are.
Yeah.
And despite the disagreements that the county executive may or may not have had with both the minority and the majority conferences within the legislature, ultimately voters will equate the success of the county ledge to the success of the county executive. I don't think that the legislative majority is necessarily in danger. I think Richie Schaefer has done a good job of being able to preserve that, and they're running some good candidates to be able to ensure that they hold on to their seats.
Yeah.
But as was the case in 2013, we are one national level problem away from all of that confidence being eroded. In 2013, folks were kind of bullish on the Democrats' chances. But then you had healthcare.gov kind of erode all of that, not just in Nassau and Suffolk, but in legislative races around the country.
Right.
While the national position on the president is not strong, while his approval ratings are in the toilet, they're lower than any
president. Still, though, party affiliation could be at stake here, is what you're saying. Just as it was a few years ago.
We are one policy change in Washington away from this being drastically different. If things escalate in North Korea or elsewhere, you could certainly see the president's numbers go up. Nothing makes a president's approval ratings go up quite like international conflict. And that could really, really change the game here.
No question about it. Speaking of change of the game, what about this president? Obviously, approval ratings, not good. Millennials, as a matter of fact, not good as far as the numbers. But he comes out yesterday with a bit of a salvo as far as, against North Korea, all the fury and everything else and the power. If you threaten the United States, guess what? And a lot of people were critical of that, including Senator John McCain, who said, you know what, those are tough words. Be careful. You're going to have to back it up. Chuck Schumer, who is Mr. Negative, you know, against everything that is all about this president, you know, he's firing off. You know, there's a lot of rhetoric back and forth here yesterday.
I think that those comments were callous, arrogant, and somewhat primitive in the way they were delivered. I don't understand how you could start from a place of fire and fury. If that's the baseline you're going to set with your dealings with North Korea, where do you go from there? If North Korea pokes you back, there's no escalation from fire and fury the likes of which the world has never seen. So you almost put yourself in a position where if there is any sort of counter rhetoric by North Korea, you almost have to act militarily or you lose your credibility. If you threaten fire and fury, you better deliver fire and fury.
In essence,
which is why you don't see presidents give these kinds of rhetorical positions.
But you can make the case it was a 15-0 vote as far as the UN and sanctions against North Korea. So in essence, Kim Jong-un basically says, okay, you're going to do that to us. Guess what? We're ready. We've got the warheads and everything else. And guess what? Guam happens to be on my radar now. What else do you expect this president to do? Pretty much. He is threatening this country. He is threatening with strikes and everything else. Listen, as delusional as everyone on this planet knows Kim Jong-un is, how else does one react?
I think that a lot of folks, including the aforementioned...
Do you keep your mouth shut, pretty much, and just let the sanctions do the talking here? I mean, what do you do?
I think sanctions are one step. And we're talking about some pretty stiff economic sanctions. I mean, we're talking about essentially taking away one-third of their international economic activity. That's a big deal for a country that doesn't even have the internet in most places. I mean, if you look at a map of the world at night... there is essentially a dark cloud in the northern part of the Korean Peninsula, which is North Korea. They call it the Hermit Kingdom for a reason, first of all. But, you know, you mentioned John McCain earlier. He and a lot of your more moderate Republicans, as well as all Democrats, it would seem, would favor a position that is more rooted in diplomacy than the heavy-handed, tough-talking rhetoric that we saw yesterday. That kind of bravado may work on the campaign trail. Clearly it did. And it may work with certain domestic issues. It may work when you're talking about getting tough on sanctuary cities within your own country. But when you're talking about a hostile foreign government, I think it is an extraordinarily dangerous to use that kind of rhetoric, especially with an individual as unpredictable as the one we're dealing with here.
How else do you handle a guy like this, though? I mean, you know, basically you've already sanctioned him. China's already chimed in here, and China now is starting to get angry. You wonder, you know, and you feel that they will be a partner in all this if it ever comes to fruition. I hope it never does. Don't get me wrong. But how else does one, you know, go after a maniacal dictator as that of Kim Jong-un?
You hit it right in the head when you said maniacal dictator. When you're dealing with someone who is as unpredictable as this character is, you have to exhaust every diplomatic option before you use force because you don't know what their idea of a retaliatory strike would be. And as a result, I mean, working with the Chinese, working with other actors in South Asia who have diplomatic relations of some kind with North Korea, it has got to be the first option here. And I don't think we're exploring those options thoroughly enough before we rattle our saber to the point where we are evoking Armageddon in a lot of the statements we're making. And I think that's a deeply problematic way to look at this problem.
All right, let's shift in the few minutes we have left. I want to shift to Albany because obviously the arrest yesterday kind of signaled something to me, at least, in the fact that, you know, I understand legislative sessions end when they're supposed to and everybody's getting ready for a summer vacation. But I brought up to you about ethics reform, still not a comprehensive deal in place, bits and pieces,
right,
as we've mentioned. And then this whole thing with the sex offenders and the registry and the expanding of the registry, an easy fix, not so easy these days up in Albany.
Nothing's easy.
Going from 20 to 30 is an easy fix. You have to wonder what Carl Hastings and company are actually accomplishing up there. But the bottom line is, this story yesterday, that was the first signal to me that there has been a lot on the table, but nothing cemented. as far as getting it done, as far as very important pieces of legislation. You could have had this done easily, and it's frustrated a lot. We're going to talk with Assemblyman Dean Murray on this. He's been a leader as trying to get things through. Not the case. Session ends, everybody goes home, and you get a story like this that breaks yesterday. Are you kidding me?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, that the state legislature should certainly be in session year-round or longer than they currently are. The reason why we have a session calendar that starts, you know, with the state of the state in early January and ends around July 1st dates back, again, to New York State being an agrarian economy where legislators would have to come home and tend to their crops. With due respect to some members from upstate New York, that's not the majority of that conference anymore. I think that New York is a very large and very industrial economy, and as a result, we should be in session longer. And by the way, we should pay our legislators more money than we currently do. I understand that $79,500 goes a long way in upstate New York, but it doesn't go very far here on Long Island, and certainly doesn't go very far in Westchester and New York City. If you want to be able to move issues like the ones you're talking about, keep them in session all year. And also, if you want to avoid people having to do nefarious things as it pertains to outside income, why not just pay these guys better? And then you wouldn't have this problem. But as I mentioned previously, one of the reasons why you're never going to see term limits in Albany, one of the reasons why it's really, really tough to enact campaign finance reform, really, really tough to enact strong ethics reform, is you are trying to undo a system that exists to enrich people for the last 200 years.
Yeah.
And so those kinds of changes are always going to be incremental when you're asking a legislative body to police themselves. And also, the issue of pay raises has been kind of, you know, been a carrot the governor has held over the legislature for a long time. You want pay raises, you know.
Campaign loopholes, term limitations, those who have the seats in power, you know, make some specifications as far as limitations are concerned.
I completely agree. And we've seen in New York City that things like public financing of campaigns and term limits and bans on contractors being able to give political money work. I mean, you have in New York City a legislative body that looks like New York City, where anyone who can raise some money can be competitive in city council races because they publicly finance campaigns. And you have turnover in that body because you have term limits. All of those things are common sense fixes that could probably work on the state and federal level.
It just irks a lot of people, especially when you try at the 11th hour to get dad's name on a bridge rather than other important issues. That's an eye-opener.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Albany is less of a cesspool now than it was 10 years ago. But we've got a long, long way to go. Absolutely. And I think there are common sense things we can do. But again, you're asking people who have a vested interest in perpetuating the current system to stop enriching themselves and pay themselves less money in most instances.
Jeff Guillot, ladies and gentlemen, political science professor extraordinaire, NASA and Suffolk, Millennial Strategies in Huntington, and new dad to Lincoln James. Listen, you're going to hear Jeff a lot as we get into the crux of the season.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Yeah, great insight today. Really was. Sorry as well.